تناديني
فلسطيني فلسطيني أنا اللي اسمك فيني
أنا الصامد على أرضي ورافع على السما جبيني
فلسطيني فلسطيني
listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. The Development and Events Committee meets on the third Monday of the month at 5:30 p.m. This month's meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Could I get two of those zucchini, please?
Sure. Anything else for you today?
What is that over in the basket?
Oh, honey, that is the organic, homegrown More Talk Radio with Cecile Prescott and Celeste Carey.
Wow, I'll take one.
It is so great. Every Monday at 8 in the morning.
How do I get more?
Well, you can support programs like this with donations by going to kboo.fm/give or texting KBOO to 44321. It is the Fresh Off the Vine Fall Fun Drive, so it's a great time to give.
More Talk Radio sounds nutritious. I can't wait to try it.
Oh, honey, you're gonna love it.
KBOO.
Hi. This is Juan Carlos Ordóñez, host of Policy for the People. Before we get to today's show, let me remind you that KBOO Community Radio has a $55,000 fall membership drive goal. And today is a great day to become a member. All donations are matched up to $14,000 thanks to a generous group of anonymous donors. KBOO's independent programming is only possible with your support. Go to kboo.fm/give and make a contribution today. Thank you, and now on to the show. Welcome to Policy for the People, a show that explores the public policies that can lift up all Oregonians. This show is a collaboration between KMUZ Radio and the Oregon Center for Public Policy. I am your host, Juan Carlos Ordóñez. According to new data recently released by the U.S. Census Bureau, the share of children in our country living in poverty has soared. In today's episode, we talk with Tyler McGinnis, a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy, about what's behind the surge in child poverty. We also discuss how the federal government measures poverty in a way that significantly understates the number of families having trouble making ends meet. In the second half of the show, we explore a different, more accurate measure of economic insecurity developed by the United Way. We talk with Jim Cooper, President and CEO of United Way of the Pacific Northwest, about the asset-limited, income-constrained, employed, ALICE for short, index, and what this measure of economic insecurity tells us about the current reality facing Oregon families. Stay tuned. So, Tyler, last month, the U.S. Census Bureau released the latest figures on poverty in the U.S. and here in Oregon. What would you say were the main takeaways from this data release?
Well, the main takeaway in the latest poverty figures, you know, the big headline is the fact that nationally, child poverty more than doubled. Child poverty across the country jumped from 5.2% in 2021 to 12.4% in 2022. That's the largest increase that we've seen in the numbers in more than 50 years. Now, for those of us who study poverty and stay on top of what's going on in Congress, this jump was not a surprise. This is something that we fully expected to see. And that's because we knew that an incredibly successful policy designed to reduce child poverty went away last year. And that policy was the Enhanced Child Tax Credit that was put into place by Congress for just 1 year in 2021. And during its brief duration, the Enhanced Child Tax Credit slashed child poverty in half, simply by getting additional cash into the hands of families who are struggling to get by. So the disappearance of this policy was inevitably going to cause child poverty to surge. And that's exactly what we saw in this latest round of numbers. So I think perhaps the biggest takeaway from the latest census data on poverty is that poverty ultimately is a policy choice. We know that there are policies out there that will shrink poverty. And the real question is, are we going to choose to implement those policies?
So I want to come back to the child tax credit and other policy implications in a bit. But first, let's talk about the Oregon angle. What did the latest data say about poverty in Oregon, and particularly child poverty in our state?
It's a great question. And frankly, this is where things get a little bit more complicated and wonky. If you look at just the year-to-year figures on child poverty in Oregon, it would appear that child poverty didn't really change. It appeared relatively flat. But then again, the Oregon figures would not have shown that significant decline in child poverty that we saw in 2021 when the Enhanced Child Tax Credit was in place. And the reason for this has to do with two different measures of poverty that are at play. The Oregon figures that I mentioned, where child poverty was unchanged, use the official definition of poverty, which is the traditional way that the federal government has measured poverty going back for decades. And that official poverty measure dates back to the 1960s. It essentially says that families are poor when their income is less than three times the cost of a modest basket of food. And so under this measure, there were 13.5% of Oregon children living in poverty in 2021 and 13.8% in 2022. Statistically speaking, there wasn't a significant difference between those two numbers, so the rate was relatively unchanged. The national figures that we talked about showing that massive increase in child poverty employs a newer measure of poverty that's been developed by the Census Bureau over the last decade or so. And this is a measure called the Supplemental Poverty Measure, which does a number of things, including taking into account the impact that some federal programs, like tax credits, have in helping families make ends meet. And so that's why when we use the Supplemental Poverty Measure at the national level, which factors in the child tax credit, we see that drop in child poverty from 2020 to 2021, and we see that resurgence in child poverty from 2021 to 2022. It's because that supplemental measure is accounting for the fact that the enhanced child tax credit went away that we see those swings. Unfortunately, at the state level, that supplemental poverty measure isn't available to us on a year-to-year basis. So we're stuck using the official poverty measure, which again, effectively shows no significant change from 2021 to 2022.
So you mentioned that the supplemental poverty measure includes things like tax credits in its calculations. What else makes the supplemental poverty measure different than the official poverty measure?
Yeah, so as I mentioned earlier, the official poverty measure goes back to the 1960s. And kind of the story behind that was at that time, there was an economist working for the US Social Security Administration who was asked to set a threshold for what does it mean to be poor in the United States. And to make a long story short, she determined at that time that the average family spent about one third of its household budget on food. And so she determined logically that the poverty threshold then could be set by multiplying the cost of a basic food plan by three. And so soon enough, the federal government began using that formula to measure poverty and would adjust it every year for inflation. But the official poverty measure doesn't take into account things like housing costs, transportation, childcare, regional differences in the cost of living, and so on. But that's the measure that we've been using now for decades. And listeners, of course, know that our economy has changed considerably since the 1960s. So pretty much any analyst who, you know, studies these things and knows anything about the official poverty measure would tell you that it's a flawed measure and it vastly understates economic need. The supplemental poverty measure then is an attempt to address some of those shortcomings that exist in the official poverty measure. It takes into account more of the basic needs that families face, takes into account regional differences and cost of living. And as I mentioned, it factors in things like tax credits and other non-cash benefits that help families meet their basic needs. So it's an improvement, certainly, over the official poverty measure, but it still doesn't fully account for what it truly takes to get by in our economy. And I should say, there are better measures out there of what it takes to make ends meet. One of those is a measure developed by the United Way, and it goes by the acronym of ALICE, which stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, and Employed. The ALICE Index, as it's known, is something that we've used at the Oregon Center for Public Policy as a better measure of what families truly need to make ends meet.
Later in the show, I'm actually going to be speaking with Jim Cooper of the United Way of the Pacific Northwest about the ALICE Index. So we'll get more insight into that different measure of economic security from him. But my question for you is, if everybody knows that the official poverty measure is flawed, why is it still around? Why are we still using it?
I think part of it is probably just inertia. You know, we've been using the official poverty measure now for more than half a century. So it's hard to move away from it. You know, a number of public benefit programs use the official poverty measure as a way of determining whether or not someone qualifies for certain kinds of assistance. And so we have it baked into our social safety net in a number of places. I think another reason is that, frankly, it's probably politically difficult to do so. Putting into place a more realistic measure, one that more closely tracks the economic realities of our country and our economy, would show that many more people are living in poverty. And not many politicians want to be responsible for changing how we define poverty in a way that's going to result in the poverty rate exploding.
Let's go back to something we touched on earlier, and that is the impact of the enhanced child tax credit that did so much to slash poverty during its brief existence. So what were those improvements that had such a profound impact on reducing child poverty, even if we're talking about a not so great definition of poverty?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a number of things that the enhanced child tax credit did that resulted in that historic decline in child poverty that we saw from 2020 to 2021. First and foremost, it made the credit larger. It was simply getting more cash into the hands of families who were struggling to make ends meet. Second, it made a portion of the credit available to families on a monthly basis rather than just a lump sum when they go to file their taxes during tax filing season. And that's really critical because, you know, as folks will recall, 2021 was still a fairly precarious time in our economy. There's a lot of uncertainty. And so ensuring that families were able to meet their monthly expenses, keep food on the table, keep the rent or the mortgage paid, and so on, that was a really critical element of what made the enhanced child tax credit successful. Lastly, and probably most importantly, in the context of reducing child poverty, is it made the credit fully available to the lowest paid families who had previously been denied all or a portion of the tax credit, depending on how much they earned. And so that ensured that we were getting resources to the families who needed them most. And so looking at those things together, you know, we made the credit larger, we were getting more cash into the hands of families, we made it available more regularly to help them meet their monthly expenses, and we were getting it to the families who needed it most. And together, those things were really a recipe for success when it came to reducing child poverty.
So given how effective the enhanced child tax credit was during its brief existence, it would seem that reinstating it would be part of any plan to seriously tackle poverty and economic insecurity in our country. Is that so? And what other kinds of policies should we be pursuing, both at the national level and here in Oregon?
Yes, I think if we've learned anything during the pandemic, it is that policies that get cash into the hands of people who are struggling to make ends meet is a smart and efficient way to ensure people are more economically secure. We saw this through the enhanced child tax credit. We saw this through the several rounds of federal stimulus checks and so on. So we need to prioritize policies that are getting cash into the hands of folks who are struggling to get by. So at the federal level, first and foremost, that looks like reinstating and making permanent the enhanced version of the child tax credit. We've also seen a wave of pilot programs across the country experimenting with cash in the form of a guaranteed income. Essentially, they're looking at what happens if we give people cash with no strings attached. And what the studies around these pilots are finding is that time and time again, guaranteed income is an efficient and effective way to bolster economic security for folks who are living on the margins. And it has a long list of positive impacts for both the individuals who are receiving the cash directly, but also to the community and the economy more broadly. So we're in this moment where we need to find a way to move from these pilots into making guaranteed income policy. And so that's something we're really focused on at the state level. And we really think that Oregon needs to establish an income floor that ensures all Oregonians have a baseline level of economic stability. So guaranteed income is something that is really critical that we want to be pursuing here in Oregon and hopefully someday at the national level. We also need to be investing significantly in those areas that we talked about earlier that the official poverty measure isn't accounting for. Things like investing more in increasing the supply of affordable housing, making childcare more accessible and affordable for families, and better paying jobs for providers. We need a lot more of those kinds of investments that help families meet those monthly expenses that aren't accounted for in the official poverty measure. And lastly, we need to ensure that folks are being paid adequately for their labor. You know, we see in too many sectors of the economy that people are paid too little for their work. And so it's been really fantastic, frankly, to see the rise in labor activity and unionizing efforts, both here in Oregon and across the country, as workers are demanding better pay in working conditions. So we need more of that kind of action, but we need policies that provide greater protections for workers to ensure that they're able to fight for those better contracts without fear of retaliation.
Well, Tyler, that sounds like a great list of work that needs to happen. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Juan Carlos.
You're listening to Policy for the People on KBOO Portland. Before we move on to our next interview, I want to remind you that this is a great time to become a member of KBOO. Your donation will be matched dollar for dollar up to $14,000. Go to kboo.fm/give and make a contribution today. Thanks, and now back to the show. That was Tyler McInnes discussing what explains the surge in child poverty confirmed by the most recent Census Bureau figures. In our conversation, Tyler mentioned the ALICE Index developed by the United Way, describing it as a better way of measuring what families truly need to make ends meet. So to get a better understanding of the ALICE Index, I spoke with Jim Cooper, President and CEO of United Way of the Pacific Northwest. Jim explained what the ALICE Index says about the extent of economic insecurity in Oregon. Here's our conversation.
Hi, Jim. Welcome to Policy for the People.
Hi, Juan Carlos. Thanks for having me.
So, Jim, can you explain what the ALICE Index is and what motivated the United Way to create it in the first place?
Yes. Yeah, so the United for ALICE project really comes about as a way to combat the federal poverty vernacular, which we all know is inaccurate. If you've ever had any experience with any state or federal programs, you know, they're often measured in 200, 300, or even 400% of federal poverty. And so United Way has wanted to know, well, what does it really cost to live on the ground in the United States, neighborhood by neighborhood, county by county, city by city, and state by state? And so they came up with this this partnership, which is driven by the United Way of Northern New Jersey and some folks out of Rutgers University. And ALICE stands for Asset Limited, Income Constrained, Employed. And so it's really a study of the situation for working families on the ground across the state of Oregon.
I'm wondering if you can describe for the listeners some of the items that the ALICE Index takes into account.
So we create a survival budget and a stability budget. And so think about survival being like the basic lowest amount of money you can afford to get by on month to month. And then the stability budget being something that includes a little bit of savings and maybe gives you the opportunity to go to a movie or do something fun during your month, which is really tough for people that are on a tight income. And so the pieces of that are looking at the cost of housing, the cost of childcare, the cost of food, the cost of technology, the cost of healthcare, and taxes. And then there's like a little bit of miscellaneous in there. So when we look at one adult with one preschooler and one infant, the total that they need to survive in 2021 numbers is $79,008. And that's a statewide figure. And we can look at that by county or city and it will change a little bit. That family needs to make almost $80,000 when you actually look at the cost of living versus the federal poverty level for a family of three is only $22,000 in the same year. So kind of think about that difference, you know, compared to what you see in your own grocery bill or your own rent or mortgage.
So the ALICE threshold varies by family size and location, but I'm wondering if you can tell us how many households in Oregon live below that survival threshold. In other words, how many households in our state are making too little to afford the basic necessities?
Yeah, so in the state of Oregon, you have 12% of the population that's in what we consider federal poverty, and another additional 32% of the population that is considered ALICE, and that we do that by household. And so your question is right on, that the total of the combined of those percentages is a little shy of 750,000 households that are struggling to get by on any given day in the state of Oregon.
So when you add up the 12% roughly of people, of households living below the poverty line, and the 32% of households that still don't make enough to make ends meet. So roughly 44% of the Oregon population, that's a huge amount encompassing all kinds of Oregonians. But I'm wondering, are there differences in the population experiencing economic insecurity compared to the rest of the population? In other words, are there differences by, say, race and ethnicity or geography or age that are important to highlight?
Absolutely. And so just the first one is looking at geography. So some counties in Oregon, that number is well above 50%. Now it might be a small population, but over half of the people are really struggling to get by. And that tends to be in more of the rural counties. Though when we look at an urban county, we will see some higher numbers in the cities than we see in the whole county, as an example. And then when we look at different populations, there's a couple of places where it stands out. And so typically across the state, we see a higher percentage of poverty plus ALICE in families of color and in single parent households. So statewide in the state of Oregon, we can see some of that discrepancy even by age. And so when you look at the population of people under 25 years old in the state of Oregon, that number is around 75% struggling to get by.
Wow.
Also, with 65 and older, you're at about half. When we look at people with pigment in their skin, you can also see some pretty significant discrepancies. So Black households are running at about 65%, Hispanic households about 55%, and American Indian, Alaska Native households running a little above 55%. Compared to, well, and I would also say two plus races are very similar to that, versus white households that are right at that 44%, and then Asian households that are doing slightly better at about 40%.
And what about differences by occupation? I'm wondering if there are categories of jobs where large numbers of working people still fall below that survival budget.
Okay, yes. So when we look at the top 20 or so occupations in the state of Oregon, we can see a few that are higher than that 44% that you mentioned. In particular, cooks at 55%, laborers like doing freight, stock, and material handling at 51%, waiters and waitresses at 51, cashiers at 59%, and stockers and order fillers at 50%. We also know that a larger portion of our early childhood workers are impacted by the cost of living, but they just don't happen to fall in the data set in the top 25 employment sectors.
The researchers at United Way who do this analysis have gone back a few years to provide some historical data. And those figures go back 15 years to the time of the Great Recession, and the analysis runs through the middle of the COVID pandemic. I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how the numbers have changed over time.
Yeah, I think two important highlights to that data trend. We, in our data goes back to 2010. So like you mentioned, just coming out of the Great Recession and then coming, you know, the economy stabilizing and then getting hit with a pandemic. And what is important to think about in this time is coming out of the Great Recession, going into the pandemic, and even coming out of the pandemic as early as 2021, we see the typical economic indicators like gross domestic product really high, and they have trend lines that are going up, and they're what we use to measure our economy by, but they don't tell the whole story. And so we definitely know that while we don't have a full report, that the Great Recession left more people in poverty and more people in that Alice category than we had ever had before. And those populations never recovered from the Great Recession. And so as we look at things, and actually in Oregon, you have some pretty progressive policies around minimum wage and other things coming in line right before the pandemic. And so you see actually the poverty line ticking down. So you see the numbers peaking at around 235,000 in poverty in 2012, and then dropping in 2021 to 201,000 households. But when we look at the Alice line, it is going up at a much sharper rate than the poverty line, which really looks flat. And so when I look at the same time period, the low point for the Alice households was 417,000 households in 2010, and we're now up to 543 households in 2021. So while you saw poverty, or that typical poverty measure relatively flat over that time, you saw the Alice population increase pretty dramatically. And so those families that didn't recover from the Great Recession have that compounded issue of a pandemic, economic uncertainty, getting a tax credit that brings their families out of poverty, and then getting slammed back into the same situation they were in the following year.
When we look at the Alice analysis and we see that 44% of Oregon households struggle to make ends meet, it really seems that what we have here is not a problem of individual shortcomings, of people making bad choices, but really what we have are structural problems with the economy. I wonder whether you agree with that, and if so, what you think are those structural problems that are causing such a huge share of the population to be economically insecure.
Yeah, clearly something's not working. And I think, you know, one of the main things that I've seen an advantage of having this report is being able to talk to policymakers, whether it's at the legislature or at Congress. We have the ability to look at their district and tell them a story. And we can see the numbers. We can see that something's clearly not working. But there's only so many levers we can pull, right? So how do we bring down the cost of housing, or how do we bring down the cost of childcare? You know, maybe we think about universal childcare, or think about free transportation policies in urban areas, you know, things that could, you know, help those families get closer to a more sustainable budget point, you know. And then the other side of that conversation is, how do we get the right jobs in our community that are living wage, that, you know, can put enough bread on the table for the whole family to survive? And, you know, those are really tough conversations. But we all know that, you know, when we look under the hood and see those inequities, we have to really think about how our society is structured and how we do public benefits so that we can make sure everyone has access to the same benefits.
Well, Jim Cooper, thank you very much.